Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about Antarctic exploration. Last year, 50 scientists from 8 countries boarded an Australian icebreaker for an expedition known as the Sea Ice Physics and Ecosystem Experiment, or SIPEX. The plan was to spend 7 weeks voyaging into the sea ice around Antarctica in order to study that ecosystem and its role in the climate system. But the trip took an unexpected turn when the ship got stuck in the ice. Dr. Clay Coons was a member of that expedition. At the time, he was a research engineer in applied ocean physics and engineering at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and he joins me now to tell his Antarctic exploration story. Welcome, Clay.
Thanks.
So just for starters, tell me a little bit about what you were doing on that cruise. What was your role and what was the research you were trying to do while in the ice?
So I was part of a group of, I think, 4 or 5 people who were working with an autonomous underwater vehicle. So this is a free swimming underwater robot. And the particular project we were doing was to build 3-dimensional maps of the shape of the underside of the sea ice. So the ice floating on top of the ocean. Now, there were a bunch of other, like you said, about 50 other scientists on board that were doing lots of other experiments at the same time that we were doing our measurements underneath the ice.
So why would we care about what the shape of the ice on its underside actually is?
Well, the problem with measuring, trying to understand how much ice there actually is in the ocean is tricky because in Antarctica, you can see from space how much extent there is. Visually, you can see, well, the ice goes out, I don't know how many hundreds of miles from the continent, but you can't measure how thick it is. Without actually going underneath it or drilling a hole through it, measuring it with a yardstick. So what this robot was trying to do is to measure the sort of the volume of the ice on a small scale locally.
And I guess if we got a better handle on generally what the shape is and measured that in some places, we might be able to then, with some of the satellite technologies, be able to estimate better what it is in other areas or at other times. Is that
right? That's the idea. So if you can figure out sort of a relationship between the shape of the ice on the surface and the shape of the ice underneath the surface, sort of correlate sort of the height above the water of the ice with the thickness of it, then you can sort of extrapolate that and sort of determine what the total volume of ice is around Antarctica. That's the idea, at least. And the reason why it's tricky is because it snows there a lot, and sometimes the snow is so deep that it pushes the ice down below sea level. So it has negative freeboard, we say. Hmm. And so it's you basically just can't measure it remotely. You have to be there.
You actually have to be there. Yeah. And this is not, we're not necessarily talking about enormous sheets of solid ice when you're in the ice. Sometimes it's smaller pieces. What are we actually talking about in terms of the configuration of the sea ice?
Right. So this is there's all kinds of different ice on the ocean, and it's all technical, but this is sea ice. So this is ice that's basically the ocean that has frozen, as opposed to chunks of ice sheets that have fallen off, or which could be like large icebergs, that kind of thing, or things that have come from glaciers are different. So this is actually just frozen ocean. You can think of it that way. So it might be anywhere from, you know, very thin, obviously, near the edge, or it could be up to several meters thick. We've seen ice that was thicker than 15 meters, so it depends on what you get.
So the plan for the SIPEX cruise that you were on, as I understand it, is basically you got on board this Australian icebreaker, the Aurora Australis, mm-hmm. and headed down, and you were actually going to drive through the sea ice, getting closer and closer to land and be making, you know, your measurements of the ice, other people's measurements of what's living there, whatever, you know, the ecosystem measurements they were making. So what's it like actually driving through the ice on an icebreaker?
It's noisy. So the idea is, the general plan is that the ship travels down to the ice zone. It finds a nice spot that it looks like a good place to do an experiment. It parks against the ice. Everyone piles off the ship, does their measurements, maybe takes 2 or 3 days. Everyone piles back on, and then the ship continues to the next station. And you do as many of these things as you can, given the amount of time you have. As the ship is going through the ice, the ship tries to maneuver between leads, which are places where floes are not mashed together too tightly, so little spaces of open water. They look almost like rivers kind of between the ice flows.
And you're finding these with satellite imagery?
Oh, there's a couple of helicopters on board the ship that they can fly up and go ahead and do reconnaissance uh-huh. flights to see what's there. They also use satellite imagery when they have it, depending on how many clouds there are overhead. So when that's happening, the ship does not drive in a straight line. It kind of zigzags its way, you know, further south or whatever direction it's going. When it actually gets into ice that's thicker, then it gets a lot noisier and starts pounding, and maybe even, if it gets really thick, the ship has to sort of ram back and forth, you know, kind of like parallel parking if you're doing a bad job of it, sort of crashing ahead, crashing back, crashing ahead, trying to break space open as you go. And that gets noisy.
Yeah. So, and then how do you actually launch an underwater vehicle or recover an underwater vehicle when you're surrounded by ice?
So like I said, the ship parks against the ice. It actually throws out mooring lines, like just as if it was parking at the dock here, except that there's no pier. You just they drill holes and bury these little 4x4 wood anchors and tie the ship to the ice. And the idea is that as the ship comes in, it's sort of clearing a little bit of open water behind it, just in its wake. And hopefully the wind is blowing such that it's not closing right back in behind it. So you have a pool of open water behind you, maybe 50 meters on a side, say. So you have open water, and we can deploy the AUV off the back of the ship, and it just is going into the water, and then we program it on a mission. It dives down and swims underneath the ice, does its mission, in this case, of about 6 hours or so, and then comes back. There's all kinds of technical issues about how to make sure it comes back under open water, because obviously you want to have it to pop up to the surface and not get stuck. And then you can drive it back to the ship once it gets onto the surface over a remote control.
So you're driving further and further into the ice. You're using the helicopters and satellites mm-hmm. to try to find the open water to actually make a path. And yet still, what, about two-thirds of the way through this cruise, you got stuck.
Yeah, we did. The weather had been consistently blowing winds from the north, and when you're far enough south and the wind's blowing from the north, it pushes all of the ice that's north of you toward the south, and of course, there's a continent. Ultimately, there's Antarctica's there, so the ice doesn't have anywhere to go, so it just piles up, and the ship got pinned into it.
Did anyone see that coming? I mean, did you kind of know that things were getting tighter and tighter packed? Was there any warning from the crew that this is getting harder?
I think it became clear that things were getting difficult, and the ship was having a harder time moving from station to station. Yes. There was a number of different people who were sort of in leadership roles on the ship, and they collectively decided that it was okay for us to take the risk of getting stuck in order to get to a specific spot that we were trying to shoot for some of the scientists. And it just turned out that we had bad luck and didn't make it. So then we got stuck, and we were stuck for a while.
Was there an announcement? All right, everybody, this is it. We're stuck. Or did that news just kind of filter down?
There was an announcement, but it was more. So we had meetings amongst all the people on board. There were like 108 people on board the ship, something like that. And we would get sort of informed as a group every couple of days as to our situation. And it was often an overly optimistic kind of report where they'd say things like, "Yeah, we seem to be pretty stuck right now. Things should turn around in a couple of days, and we'll start making our way back north." Actually, it wasn't even making our way back north at that point because we weren't overdue at that point. So it was, we'll just make our way to the next station once things open up. And every couple of days, we kind of get the same message over and over again, and it never really changed until actually it became clear that we were going to be overdue. And all
so,
of a sudden,
so how yeah. long were you stuck?
We were the ship wasn't really completely wedged in, and we had like turned the engines off, like nothing to do. For maybe 10 days, we were still trying to bash our way around and not really making much progress. And then after that point, we were stuck probably for another couple of weeks, I think. We ended up being about 10 days overdue when we came back.
Did you ever get concerned? I mean, about safety and about whether or not you would be able to get back out?
No. There was, we were there in, I think it was November. So that's the austral spring, right? So we knew that ultimately summer was going to come and it was going to melt everything anyway. So it was just a question of how soon that was going to happen. I think some people made jokes about getting our Christmas decorations ready, and this was before Thanksgiving. So I think that most of us did not find that very funny. obviously didn't turn out to be necessary. And I think that people expected, okay, look, this might take a couple of weeks, but there's no risk of us having to spend more than that much time here because the ice was ultimately going to melt. Had it been February or March, then there would have been a different issue. We actually have had to overwinter, which would have been a bigger problem.
I mean, obviously, this is always a possibility when you mm-hmm. start driving into the ice on an icebreaker. This was a calculated decision, knowing that there was a risk of getting stuck. So is the ship provisioned to make it, you know, if you're out there in November until the end of December, January, February, however long you might be there?
Yes, absolutely. There are, it's a big ship, so there's containers full of emergency supplies and that sort of a thing. And in fact, the ship also is used to provision the Australian bases down there. I think there's three that it makes regular stops to during the austral summer, and it always has extra supplies on board in case things get bad. Having said that, it doesn't mean you're going to live comfortably, right? So you might have no problem surviving for an extra couple of months, but you might not really enjoy the fact that there's no coffee and, you know.
I mean, do you basically go into ration mode with the basics?
I think so. We didn't actually have to do that. We did run out of coffee, which was kind of a bummer.
That is a bummer.
But that was about the extent of the degree to which we had to to deal with that sort of thing. We ran out of toilet paper too, which is a bummer.
That's a real bummer.
Yeah.
No coffee and no toilet paper.
We used paper towels.
That constitutes roughing it in my books. What did you do? I mean, let's talk about the first 10 days when nobody's really fully accepted that you're stuck.
Right.
You're still thinking, we're going to get out of here. The next report, we're going to be on our way to the next station. What did you do for those 10 days?
So the first few days when we basically said, okay, this is, we're throwing up our hands and we're just going to have to wait for the conditions to improve. The first couple of days, we actually, the science party just treated it like a regular opportunity to take measurements. So everyone piled off the ship because a lot of the measurements are taken on foot on the surface of the sea ice. They went out there, did their work. But like I said, it only takes a couple of days really to measure everything that you came to measure. So after that point, we started to try to do things to keep up our morale. We had a barbecue on the ice, which was pretty fun. People got out there with, you know, skis and a couple of bicycles, actually, which didn't really work very well.
Why did people have bicycles on an icebreaker?
I don't know why they had, this is the crew of the ship. I don't know why. They have all kinds of stuff on board that ship, but I think they may have had studded tires on them. It didn't really work. But they did have cross-country skis and snowshoes and things like that. And there was an area that the sort of the people in charge of safety staked out on the ice to sort of mark off as a, you guys can go out there whenever you want, and there's no risk of you falling through, for example. We were visited by a minke whale for a couple of days, which was pretty neat. He came along and punched up through a thinner section of ice and hung out for several hours. Every 5 minutes or so, the whale would pop out and take a few breaths. And then, so there, he was surrounded by photographers waiting to take pictures. That was kind of a bad sign because it meant that there was nowhere else for the whale to go to breathe.
That was as good as it got.
Yeah,
you guys were right there.
So we were socked in at that point because the whale was with us, I guess.
So then after those first 10 days, you realize you're really stuck. This could be for a while. People are making jokes about being here potentially for, you know, 6-8 more weeks.
Right.
Then what do you do to keep yourself busy?
Read a lot of books, watch a lot of movies. There were some people on board who actually went out and started doing some construction of objects in the ice. Some people built igloos. There was this really interesting sort of double arch construction that took about 4 days to build that a group of about six people went out and built.
We actually have a time-lapse video of that construction process on our website that you can go and look at. And, you know, it starts off looking basically like an igloo. And I was, you know, watching it and going, okay, when is this going to actually turn into art? And by the end, it is. It's a gorgeous structure. It's really, you know, engineering meets art to have these two arches made out of ice and the blocks being held together. But one of the things that struck me as I was watching it is this is time lapse. Mm-hmm. And everybody would be really busy and then everybody would disappear. And the quality of the light when everybody disappears from the video changed very slightly, but it doesn't get dark. Right. And then everybody comes back and they're very busy and then everybody disappears. And at first I'm thinking maybe this is meals. And then it occurred to me that, oh, this is Antarctica in the spring. That's probably night. How many days did it take? How many days did they spend all day, every day, basically building this structure?
Well, I think it took about 4 or 5 days to build. And actually, the video is edited. So it did get dark there for maybe 4 hours a night. So there actually are some pictures that are really gorgeous because the ship has some very bright searchlights that it shines in front of it when it's ice breaking at night. So it can see, you know, what is in front of it. Like on a ship at night, generally in the open ocean, you don't have any lights at all because there's nothing to worry about crashing into. On an icebreaker, you need those. And so they would actually train those lights on the sculpture so people could work in the 4 or so hours of darkness if they wanted to. It did get colder at night, so the people generally didn't do that. But
I was going to say, I mean, people weren't taking the opportunity to sleep on a normal schedule.
No, people generally stuck to a regular normal schedule throughout the entire cruise, actually. But So during that video, you see conditions are changing. The weather kind of blows in and goes out. Some days it's clear, some days it's cloudy. The sun does move a little bit, and it does actually go down, but that part got cut from the video.
I mean, you've got 100 people on a ship that's now stuck in the middle of the Antarctic ice. You're not sure for how long. I imagine tensions could have been running pretty high. How do you manage? I mean, this is cabin fever with 100 people.
Yeah. It didn't get too bad. I think that there was a bit of grumbling. I certainly had some grumbling, you know, about the frustrating thing is there's nothing really else to be said, right? You can say, look, we think conditions are going to improve in 3 days. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. And as someone who's receiving that information, you think, okay, come on, just lay it to me. Am I stuck here for 10? Am I stuck here for 20? And the honest answer is they don't really know. So they might say it's going to be 3 days just to make everyone feel better. But really what you want to know is, okay, can you give me like a range? Is it going to be somewhere between 3 and 30, or is it going to be somewhere between 3 and 8? Because that sort of mentally prepares me for that. And that information
sounds
wasn't
like
really
the scientist in you speaking. You want the nice confidence interval.
Well, I want to be able to call home and say, look, I'm going to be late, but it's not going to be, I'm going to make Thanksgiving. You know, I want to know that I'm going to make that. But that's the kind of thing that,
I mean, you've got a wife and kids
now that
are at home and you're stuck in the ice.
Yeah.
Sorry, honey. I'm not sure when I'll be home.
Right. Right. And that's the I'm not sure part is the hard part. If I could just say, yeah, I'm going to be 2 weeks late, then okay, we can prepare for that. But if it's, I'm going to be indefinitely late.
Yeah, that's a little harder to take.
Right.
So how did you eventually get free?
Well, the weather did shift, and ultimately, again, we had helicopters flying up every, I don't know, maybe 6 hours or so to check out the situation. And finally, we saw that there was, it was really kind of crazy. There was open water all over the place except for where we were, right? So we were stuck in the middle of this ice
Not
flow.
Not what you wanted to find. Not,
and you're like, look, it's great everywhere, but here. And it's like, okay, well, what are we going to do about that? Finally, it got to the point you actually could see the open water from the bridge. And so it was about a quarter of a mile away. And finally, they're like, okay, it's worth it. Make it an effort. It took us 24 hours to go that quarter mile to break out.
And that sounds like it was probably a loud, jarring 24 hours.
Yeah, it was slow, but... Everyone was, not everyone, but a lot of people were piled up on top of the bridge, you know, kind of cheering for the mate who was driving at that time. And come on, you know, oh, go that way. Everyone's trying to, like, you know, backseat drive this gigantic ship.
Which I'm sure he appreciated.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and they would write notes saying, yes, we know what we're doing. No, we don't know when we're going to get out. Please stop asking us, you know, that kind of thing.
Hopefully maintaining a sense of humor.
It was, though. Yeah, it was generally speaking, pretty good humor all around.
In the end, were you able to complete your research goals?
Of course, everyone always wants more. In the polar regions, generally speaking, things take longer than what you expect, pretty much as a universal rule. So we didn't get to as many ice stations as we would have liked to, but the science that we accomplished at each station was what we were shooting for. So, yeah.
And would you do that again?
I think so. Yeah. Not every year. It's a long time to be away from home. I mean, it's an incredible experience, but, you know, I was gone for 10 weeks, I think, 8 or 10 weeks. And, I wouldn't want to do it every single year, but it is a really great experience.
Clay Coons of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun.